Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm here with Omar Eltaray, our Senior Director of Research, to provide you with the latest news and trends in the commercial real estate market. Today, we're excited to have a special guest on with us, Chad Lavender of Newmark. Chad serves as President of Capital Markets for North America. In his role, Chad brings together all aspects of Newmark's capital markets teams, working closely with brokers to identify and leverage cross-platform synergies. Chad has completed investment sales, recapitalizations, debt, and joint venture equity transactions totaling more than $37 billion in value throughout the U.S., and previously served as co-head and vice chairman for the company's healthcare and alternatives real estate assets platform. Chad, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be fun. I'm excited to be here.
Great. Omar, I'll kick it over to you to start us off.
Fantastic. Really excited to have the conversation with you, Chad. Let's start off by going through a little bit of your background so our listeners, if they're not familiar with you, can get a little bit more familiar with you. You started in development during the GFC, probably not the ideal time to start, but then you really turned that into something special, building a leading seniors housing practice before ultimately taking the helm at Newmark for the capital markets team. Can you tell us a bit about your career path and any of the kind of key milestones, or if there were any critical kind of inflection points along the way that helped shape that path?
Sure, absolutely. Obviously, getting out of school, I graduated from University of Alabama in December of 2007, to start my illustrious real estate development career at Harwood International in Dallas. And it was a ton of fun because we had a bunch of properties under construction, and it took a little longer for the GFC to really hit Dallas. So we actually had momentum when I got out of school, and pretty quickly that momentum was going to stall for quite some time. And, you know, did the typical bank workouts, get deals finished, hand-to-hand combat at every level, really all over the country and all the way to London on the development front. And then I wanted to get really in the transaction game because it was clear to me that the development window was going to be closed for a long period of time, even though I didn't really know how long. Went and I think I had 62 meetings. I still have the spreadsheet of everyone I met with in 2009 and 10 and begged everyone, obviously for a job, but also said, I know you're not hiring. Please just introduce me to two new people. And people like Bill Duvall at Lincoln Property Company took a cold call from me, introduced me to two more people, introduced me. And it finally, I made it to ARA and worked for Brian O'Boyle selling apartments, Class C apartments, where you could see there were some rough properties back in the day. And quickly realized that there was this rotation of institutional capital rotating to senior housing because it was a best performing asset class through the GFC. So partnered with Ryan McConaughey, still my partner today on the senior housing front. And we set out to build the number one senior housing platform in the country. The right answer in 2010, 11, 12 was to refinance, not sell. So we're telling all our clients to refinance. But at the time, ARA didn't do debt and equity. We went and pitched HFF to go, let us start a senior housing platform, let us build a full service solution for our clients to serve them on the debt, equity, and sales side. Did that for 8 years at HFF, had a lot of fun, and then moved back to Newmark in 2019. But we reunited with all our friends at ARA because Newmark had bought ARA. So it was like a fun reunion to come back. And our goal was to double our market share every year. And we did that for 10 years straight. So it was a lot of fun until COVID, I guess, when it tried to eat senior housing.
So, Chad, if you don't mind, would you give us an overview of Newmark Capital Markets, maybe go through debt, equity, JV, loan sales, advisory, tell us a little about those cross-platform synergies.
Yeah, so we are full-service capital markets provider. So we start really on the investment sales side. I think we're number two this year in MSCI rankings on the investment sales side. So we're growing market share very rapidly. We do debt, basically commercial debt, and then we do Fannie, Freddie, and HUD lending through another acquisition, Berkeley Point at Newmark. And we do a ton of JV equity. We have a full service real estate advisory business. So we do private market investment banking. So a lot of continuation funds, a lot of GP-led vehicles. We're selling secondary positions in funds. A couple take privates and out so far this year. So a little bit of everything. And then we meld that with the agency leasing property management platform. We also do fund accounting, fund administration, property accounting, a lot of different things on the investor side for clients.
So as you look to, let's say, the 2026-2027 cycle, how are you positioning some of your producer teams? Is there specific training, maybe sector focus? What's that looking like?
I think it's just being super open and sharing information. So information and data is the key to advising a client. So the better information flow you have, we have a system called IDEAL where it tracks all our CAs, all our tours, all our offers, our debt quotes. So you can see at the market pricing, who's active, who isn't active, buyer recommendation engine, which shows if someone's looking at a property in Florida with certain characteristics, they should look at the same demographic property in Texas. So it's really trying to arm our and weaponize our producers to get the best client outcomes and the best pricing or the best debt possible.
Okay, so that's a great overview of kind of day-to-day and your role in your firm. If we were to step back, I think you have a phenomenal kind of viewpoint in your role to see the higher level trends. What's your read on the current U.S. macro and CRE capital markets as we close out 2025?
I'd say the read is kind of steady as it goes. It's kind of up and to the right. It's just a slow climb. Sales volumes up 19% year over year, still below 2017 through 19 levels. That origination side's up 48% over 24 and 17% above pre-pandemic levels. So we're seeing things improved. It's really asset by asset class. And really, every deal has its own story, and it's really story-driven from an outcome perspective and really trying to solve the client's needs.
But Desiree, do you have a base case that you are expecting to see through 26 and beyond for benchmark rates as well as kind of overall credit conditions?
Yes, I think we believe that rates are going to be in that 3.5% to 4% on the SOFR side. The Treasury is going to stick, 10 years going to stick somewhere in the upper 3s to 4% and hover around that level. We've seen credit spreads continue to stay tight, which has really helped. We're seeing a stubborn inflation, low growth so far this year, and we're hoping to start to see some GDP acceleration next year, and really looking at supply demand from a micro location standpoint to really improve fundamentals on the asset level, not just look at where the capital markets are.
Have you seen any data that's showing, whether it's maybe through your IDEAL system or platform, that is showing changes to bid-ask behavior across different CRE sectors?
Yeah, it's certainly narrowed, and our closing ratio is up this year. So it's certainly narrowed. I think there's enough data to know how to price assets and manage clients' expectations appropriately. So our close ratio is way up, but it's still tough. You know, on the apartment side of the business, we're seeing some bad debt and some stubborn occupancy kind of sticking below that 95% in some markets. You know, some markets like the West Coast are performing very well. So, you know, not all markets and assets are created equal at any given time. So it's really a very bespoke answer per asset, per market. But we're seeing tons of liquidity and really willingness and a desire to do transactions. Let's say folks were office curious last year and now they're office serious and want to go buy office across the country. So we're seeing we've come off the bottom. Cap rates, you know, they've kind of leveled off and they've really been helped by credit spreads staying tight.
And diving into the point around liquidity, if we can double click on kind of some of the financing trends, who's lending at what leverage point? Are you seeing any changes to structures being either in favor or out of favor? And maybe I would assume this almost varies by sector, but any of these kind of high level trends that you're paying attention to, I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the banks come back in a big way. We've seen the debt fund liquidity continue to be ultra strong. They're doing a ton of the construction lending out there and all the transitional loans. The banks have super stable deposit bases, so they need to get out debt. You know, on the sector side, you know, office is up 77% year over year. I believe senior housing's up 60%+, retail 60%+, data centers over 70%. So we've seen all these niche sectors up quite a bit, as well as traditional sectors like office. Banks are the anchor, I would say, and their originations are up 85% compared to 2024. So we've seen a big influx there as well.
Fantastic. And so moving up the capital stack, what are you seeing in terms of equity contributions and the equity capital? Are you seeing any differences between U.S. and foreign, or maybe looking at the structure in terms of JV participation? What are some of the key equity themes?
Yeah, so there's $350 billion of dry powder, which is down 17% since 2022. So still a significant amount and almost historic amount of dry powder trying to deploy. And most of that equity is really skewed towards the residential and industrial sectors. You know, the Odyssey Index Core Funds have had 12 straight quarters of net outflows. We're hearing that trend is starting to change a bit, which we're excited about. We're seeing Odysseys go really aggressively on stuff they like, and they're trying to rotate into the alternative asset classes. And we've been a big help, and it's been a lot of fun working with them. I'd say private buyers have kind of dominated. They've deployed over $187 billion, up 27% year over year. So they have picked it up and then some. The institutional capital's up 15% since 2024, but still like 25% below pre-COVID averages. And REITs and foreign investors have been less active. Obviously, the REITs aren't trading well in most asset classes. Probably, I wouldn't include certainly healthcare, where they've been ultra active in that description. But that whole, the REITs and foreign capital are down 40% to 60% since pre-COVID. So I'd say the private buyers really picked up a lot of that. We're seeing quite a change though from the amount of discussions, the amount of really offers and JVs that we're working through on the offshore capital team. We've been number one 2 years in a row in importing capital into the U.S. from offshore. And Alex Fauché runs our offshore desk, and he's done a fantastic job with his team. So we're at the tip of the spear in a lot of those discussions, and they're definitely heating up.
And maybe if you can answer this, because I am curious if the interest from offshore, does a strong dollar help or hurt that?
I would say that it helps having a weaker dollar, but I'd still say the dollar's still the reserve country for the world, and people want as much cash in dollars as they possibly can, and we have the best rule of law, so we're seeing a lot of inbound investment, and a lot of people still believe the U.S. has the best potential for higher returns, as well as law and order and a safe haven for their capital.
Fantastic. And kind of a final kind of macro comment before we dive into sectors. Is there any data point that you're paying attention to, or any market or kind of micro signal that is on your radar that you think maybe the broader industry is not paying as much attention to?
We're really focused on GDP growth because that's going to drive demand and a better consumer, whether it's someone leasing a property or renting a property, in all aspects of the real estate business. So that's something we're ultra focused on, is how the GDP forecast and the outlook looks like for America.
So Chad, Omar already alluded to this, but you spent a lot of your career in the alternative sectors. So we wanted to dig into some of those, but how would you exactly define, or what property types would you put under the umbrella of alternatives, and why do we consider them to be alternative?
Yeah, I would say partially, you know, it's interesting. The Odyssey's benchmark, the core sectors, apartments, office, industrial, retail as the primary categories. And we view the alternative sectors as medical office, senior housing, nursing care, data centers, life science, student housing, self-storage, affordable housing, manufactured housing, age-restricted, cold storage, parking. I think those are the main ones. I may have forgot one or two, but I think that's it.
And how do these stack up against the traditional sectors? I mean, I know Odyssey has kind of encroached upon that space a little bit, but it's taken a while. How do you stack those up against one another?
I would say certainly there's an incredible amount of interest in data centers, and we've had 70% market share on the data center capitalization front. So we've been very active there. It's been a ton of fun. The quantum of dollars is so large that not everyone can play in the data center space, but there's a huge amount of interest there. The hyperscalers are obviously driving the market and driving tenant demand. You know, they own 38% of their assets. But we're still seeing a lot of demand where they want to be the tenant, and really a lot of powered land plays around the country. So that's been fun to watch. The fundamentals are phenomenal. You have great credit on your leases. The senior housing sector from an NOI growth perspective has really outperformed any asset class, and I think is poised to do so. Very little construction in the future. The demographics are getting better every year, and you're in the silver tsunami phase of the age-appropriate senior. We're seeing a ton of demand for age-restricted housing. That's apartments that basically have a 55-plus designation. But, you know, NOI growth for Green Street and others is projected higher in senior housing than any other asset class for the next 3 years. You look at the public REITs and their performance and their prints, they're phenomenal. So a lot of people are looking, what asset class can I create alpha through operations and really make my return by growing NOI, not improving capital markets? And a lot of people are focused on senior housing, a lot of new capital, and a lot of capital that hasn't been in the industry in a long time is back. So it's a ton of fun in the sector right now. Medical office, people are seeing great performance there. You have a 90% tenant retention ratio. Sales are up 20% medical office this year, as opposed to pre-pandemic levels. Senior housing is on par-ish with pre-pandemic levels, but 67% above 2024. So you're seeing capital flow to these sectors where they think they can grow their NOI in a meaningful way and grow their asset value through, you know, an operational asset class.
So, Chad, I want to dig into healthcare and senior housing a little bit. I know you have some deep expertise in this space. For our listeners, do you mind breaking down different sectors here? Tell us a little about some of the KPIs that you track for independent living versus assisted or memory care. What are the things that swing the most value in those subtypes?
I'd say it really starts at age-restricted. And your average age of your age-restricted resident is about 73 and a half years old. Your average length of stay is 5 years, and your rent-to-income ratio is 3x Class A multifamily. So you have a really wealthy renter. 80-plus percent of the people have just sold a home and moved in. So you have a really wealthy renter, a super sticky tenant, and that has a lot of money to spend discretionarily on rent. So we've seen great rate growth there, despite even in high supply markets where you have a downward trend on apartment rent, we've seen 5-6% rent growth on age restricted. On the independent living side, your average resident is about 82 years old. They're provided 3 meals a day, activities, and a lot of fun amenities in the buildings. And, you know, your rent's much higher, generally 50% higher than age-restricted housing. There's no care provided, and it's a pretty healthy senior. And then assisted living, you're generally 83, 84 years old. They're getting care, meaning like help with walking, med management, those type things. And then memory care, your average age is about 85. And all predominantly private pay in most cases. And, you know, you have a really wealthy renter and kids that are willing to supplement their parents if needed so they can get the socialization in a senior housing project and be in there with their friends and peers, not sitting at home solo.
We've all kind of heard the story that silver tsunami is on the horizon if it's not already here, and that there's a true undersupply of seniors housing. But we know there are different levels here. So where's the true undersupply in terms of care level? And if you could go even further, where in terms of metro?
I think it's across the board. And it's, I would say it's more micro market dependent and the metro and metros across the country. We're seeing fantastic performance in almost every market and rapidly rising occupancy groups able to push rent in an outsized manner. And there's so much operational leverage on the rent side. So when you're pushing rents, it's really moving your NOI in a big way.
So who's buying these properties, at least the ones that presently exist? And was this value add or what's the play here?
I'd say the REITs have a very core cost of capital and then some. You have a lot of couple of Odyssey Index core funds who've bought in their housing buckets out of their Odyssey core funds. You have core plus equity, you know, opportunity funds lying down the street, and certainly plenty of value add money. So there's capital for anything in senior housing. If it's a modern building with 80 plus units where they can have enough operational leverage to stay full and run a great margin.
What do financing terms look like for some of these products today? Is this HUD agency, or if you could dig into HUD agency versus banks, private credit, what are we looking at?
Generally, it's the same cast of characters that are on the multifamily side. We've seen, just like we've seen all the equity players roll into the space, we've seen all the debt funds and banks try to do the same to get allocated to the space. We've closed a ton of first-time bank debt fund deals for first-time lenders this year, first-time life companies. So we're seeing a ton of equity. You're generally 20 plus or minus 20 basis points wide of multifamily, but we've seen that start to narrow over the last 12 months as performance continued to prove itself out on the senior housing side. So we expect those spreads to narrow.
Shifting to another kind of hot sector, data centers, I think you'd have to be like living under a rock to not be aware of the boom that's happening, whether it's hyperscale, wholesale, colo, edge, right? There is a pretty wide variety of data centers. Where are you seeing the most kind of demand and I would say interest from capital?
All the hype is on the hyperscalers, and that's what's getting the most press. But the co-located facility, all those, that has been building over time and still very stable, very good tenant demand. But the hyperscalers are really driving most of the development right now. It's a modern day gold rush for powered land to go build data centers. So the quicker you are to getting significant density of power, cooling, water, fiber, if you have all those things, and we've seen this blend from infrastructure money as well as real estate, general real estate money converge and invest in the space.
The topic of obsolescence risk is also a concept that pops up pretty heavily in the data center space. Have you seen any change in how that's being underwritten or looked at, whether from capital sources or from investors?
No, because you generally have 15 years of term on most of these leases. And a lot of times your credits are rated higher than the U.S. government. So I think people feel pretty good that they're going to get paid their rent and certainly have a zero basis at the end just from the rent they get paid along the way.
Fantastic. If you had to either guess or if you have a sharper view, how much longer do we have in this development, this data center boom and kind of development cycle?
We don't see it slowing down, like from the willingness and the demand for tenants. We haven't seen any pause, even a deep breath on that front. And I'd say the same goes for powered land. We're seeing an incredible amount of demand and really just a ton of people chasing great sites with great tenant demand.
So Chad, one of those sectors that I think has no doubt had a big slowdown, and you mentioned earlier, is life science. Do you mind walking us through like what truly qualifies as some of this lab grade life science space, and where are some of these conversions?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the floor loads, the shafts, the vibrations the buildings can take, ceiling heights, is it a clean room, is all those type things. We're really looking at the NIH budgets, VC flows, biotech IPO window, translating into leasing. So that's what's really driving it. We're seeing a lot more interest in purpose-built product versus conversions. And we're seeing a relatively active market. It's a little slower than we'd like, but we're hoping it picks up when there's a little more clarity on the VC, biotech, IPO side, and certainly the NIH budgets.
So what are some of those tenant factors, or what specific tenants really command a premium for that space?
It really depends on if you're doing R&D or if you're doing biomanufacturing. So I'd say they're all a little different, and they're looking not just for what's in their building, but the talent surrounding it. The Cambridge market is still doing super well because the talent all around it is really driving that whole market. The Bay Area is still chugging along. San Diego, I'd say the more pioneering biotech locations, they're having a harder time landing tenants and really building a true new life science location.
So this is very TILC heavy stuff. And so I'm curious if you have any insight on which lender groups are attracted to this and what's the profile of those deals?
Yeah, a lot of times you still have a fantastic counterparty on the leasing side with a great balance sheet. So in that case, your typical banks are doing a lot of those deals. We've seen debt funds also lend as well. So I'd say the same groups that have always been there, they're just really focused on what their basis is, who their tenant is, and making sure, you know, they're money good, collecting their rent.
Is there a space for mezz or pref in those capital stacks?
There is. We haven't seen as much of it as of late, and we haven't seen as much development in general. There definitely is, and there's an active market there, and a lot of people extremely educated on the space.
Is that just a quick follow-up there? Is development somewhat slowed down because we overbuilt coming out of the pandemic, or was there this kind of glut of life science space? Because if you just look at overall lending, you've seen the banks have still been less focused on construction and development. Yeah. So I'm just curious if it's a supply or of capital or kind of a oversupplied market.
I think it's all tenant driven. So if you have a healthy VC market, IPO market, and the NIH is given a ton of grants for people to go spend money, you're going to have a ton of tenant demand. And we're in a mild pullback on those fronts right now. There's not as much tenant growth right now in the market, and we're hoping that changes.
Awesome. And shifting a bit to MOB or medical office building, I think you mentioned 90% tenant retention, sales up 20%. Those are impressive. I hadn't heard those stats. And kind of what's the thesis right now for medical office building?
Just like the senior housing demand is growing, our population's aging. So there's need for more medical office in lots of markets. And I'd say there's need for modernized medical office. So a lot of physicians are ultra focused on the environment they want to bring their patients in. So we're seeing a lot of demand and a lot of people moving around, physicians moving out of hospitals, physicians moving back into hospitals in some markets. So every market's a little different. There's a ton of demand, and it's a super sticky sector. Once people have their patients trained on going to a location, they don't want to change it. They want to keep and stay in that building if possible and continue to serve their patients.
And what's the financing look like for this? Who's in that space? What's the pricing look like compared to other sectors?
Yeah, a pricing super tight. It's near industrial multifamily from an all-in coupon perspective. The banks and certainly the CMBS market are driving that sector, and debt funds for like transitional deals that have a business plan, tons of liquidity on the debt side.
What's the capital stack look like, or is it pretty vanilla?
It's pretty vanilla. You have great operators in the space. Your operator can add a lot of value in the space from being in it every day. And then you have LP capital that knows the space well, and a ton of new LP capital. That's a place where we've seen a lot of foreign capital flow through on a lot of recapitalizations we've run, as well as just new Odyssey Index Core Fund capital and other capital flow out.
So one of the sectors we haven't touched on yet that I know you mentioned was single family rentals or build to rent. For our listeners' sake, what's your investable definition of BTR versus, say, scattered site FTR? And maybe what do you think is more efficient operationally speaking?
I'd say the BTR side certainly more efficient and easier to operate with all the homes located on one parcel of land. So you don't have to drive. There's no wasted time driving from property to property. We've seen the BTR side be pretty resilient. We've seen your rent to own ratio is at an all-time wide spread. You know, your cost to rent versus owning, it's a little over $1,200 spread. Normally, I think 12 years in a row, that spread was $404 to rent versus own. So now we're at $1,200. So a big delta there. So we're seeing a lot of renters and a lot of people choose certainly BTR and SFR to go raise young families who aren't able to buy a home right now, and also renters by choice, people who want to move around and test drive a location before they buy it.
And who's setting the pricing for this? Is it the Publix, with forward purchases or takedowns, or what are we looking at there?
Yeah, I would say a lot of it is, say, core and core plus money. There's been a lot of capital raised just to deploy into the BTR sector. We're doing a couple large recaps right now where we have a very diverse pool of investors wanting to come into the sector. So I would say this falls under the residential investor bucket, and virtually everyone wants to deploy into the space.
And then looking at the debt side and talking specifically about BTR here, what's the structure to best handle this infrastructure? Is it bank construction? Who are the permanent lenders? What are we looking at here?
Yeah, it's banks and also groups doing it on lines of credit. So we've seen both. A lot of the public home builders are building these on a line. A lot of large owners or developers are doing this off a line, which is ultra efficient. We're seeing people do traditional construction loans or debt fund loans. About 30% of the market is debt funds on the construction side right now.
Chad, we just ran through five of the kind of big categories within alternatives. Are there any emerging alternatives that you're paying attention to that maybe we didn't ask about, but they got your attention?
Yeah, I don't think it's emerging, but just like the other sectors we've talked about, Newmark has the number one affordable housing sales platform in the country. We're seeing a ton of institutional interest on the affordable side across the country. A lot of generational owners are choosing to sell and scale or recap their portfolios and scale right now. So we're seeing a ton there. The manufactured housing business, ton of interest. It's hard to get scale in that business. The deal size is small. The fundamentals are fantastic. Student housing business, we're up year over year there. Number one in that business as well. Ton of recaps, a ton of continuation vehicle business. So very dynamic investor base, really resilient performance so far. And then the storage business has started to turn the corner to the positive, and we're seeing a lot of interest there as well.
And so shifting out from the kind of sector view and now looking at structure view, I feel as though at every kind of inflection point, or whether it's in the inflection point within the broader CRE cycle, or as we enter and exit phases of the cycle, we seem to see new structures gaining popularity. Is there anything that you've seen in terms of structuring that is gaining traction or losing favor?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say on the gaining traction side, we've seen a lot of GP-led recaps. We've seen a lot of continuation vehicles. We've seen a lot of people sell secondaries interest in their funds. We're doing a lot of NAV-based lines of credit. Certainly a lot of flow on the loan sales side. Not as much action as when we sold Signature Bank on behalf of the FDIC for $60 billion, but we're still doing a ton there, helping our clients. But other than that, there's a ton of interest in the recapitalization side for a lot of the GPs who are basically prepped out from an IRR perspective. So there's no promote left, who believe in their assets and want to go for another run with them. Their LPs are exhausted. So we're doing a ton of recaps really across virtually every sector right now. We've worked on a few public to privates this year. So we're seeing a lot of interest. There's a ton of interest. Very few happening, but we've been in the middle of most of them, which has been fun. But people are trying to be ultra creative. There's a solution and people are reacting fast to any needs in a capital stock.
Well, Chad, Thank you so much for joining us today. I have one final question, which we ask all our guests. If you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
That we would have a permanent solution on the debt side, like Fannie Freddie, for all asset classes. So there's permanent liquidity in the debt, no matter what the market is or the capital markets are doing. And just maybe this a 2% treasury forever.
Incredible. Thank you so much. I think that is all the time we've got. And I want to thank you for joining us. And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was fun.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.